What's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem. I am Dave Smith. He is, of course, Robbie the Fire Bernstein. Fire, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Been working hard putting together those porches. Go to robbernsteincomedy.com. I think that's my website. Just out of Detroit. Going to do an OKC late show. Got two Connecticut shows. Got a show in Long Island City coming up. So a lot going on. Busy weekend.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, well, we're... That's right. Wait, so you're doing additional shows on this run?
Just one. Sunday night, I'm going to run my FBI thing. Anyone wants to come out late night, awesome. You know, come hang out on the porch.
Awesome. If you can't make the Saturday show or if you can make the Saturday show, but also can make the Sunday show, come on out. By the way, I've literally just, I don't know. I haven't had this problem ever before, but I got an email from Twitter that was like, it's been determined that your post violated our community guidelines. And I was like, what is this, 2019? Like, what do you mean? I was like, I'm sitting there. I'm like, what did I even say? Like, you know, like, I don't know. But anyway, then I find out as I'm looking through it and trying to click the appeal, it's all so complicated. But they go, they're like, it's a copyright strike. I figure out. Then they go, we've reviewed it and determined it is in fact a copyright strike. Do you want to appeal it? And then it's like the links for what the two posts are. And you know what the posts are? They're the flyers for this weekend. That's what they said is copyright. It's mine. I mean, it's not mine. I paid an artist to make it, but I paid an artist to make it. It's mine. Like, what logo? The Bricktown Comedy Club? I promise you, they're okay with me using it. They want me to sell tickets for this show. So anyway, got to go figure that out after the show.
I have a suggestion for you, which is you and I...
cancel the weekend.
Yeah, we're done. You and I don't speak robot. You need robots to speak robot. And so you just got to go to ChatGPT, screenshot, hey, this is my flyer. Please give me a legal response. And then you just copy and paste it in. Because you and I, we don't speak robot. You need robot to speak robot. Yeah.
Where is Lex Friedman when you need him?
Yeah. My Hitler joke, which did exceptionally well on Instagram, got the most views of anything. Recently, it's been up for 6 months and I got a content strike on it. And then I tried to appeal and it just didn't process it. They're always out to get you. I instantly went to go, hey, this is a joke, and then press next and it just didn't go through.
Dude, it was like a... thank God, at least it does seem to have held a little bit that we're, I'm not saying tech censorship isn't still a thing, but it does seem to be much, much better than it was just a few years ago. But like when you have these moments, it almost reminds you of a fear. Do you remember like how crazy it would all first? It's not just that they would be censoring you. It was that the process to even figure out what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say was like, so they made it so difficult. Like, it wasn't even just like, okay, look, here are the rules. You're not allowed to say these five things, in which case you could at least make a decision. Okay, do I want to just boycott the platform? Do I want to go on there and still say what I can get away with saying? But it was literally like the way the government makes you pay taxes, where they're like, you owe us taxes. And you're like, how much? And they're like, well, that's not for us to say. You know, that's your job to figure out. And you're like, wait, so... I can just put whatever I want. And they're like, oh, no. If you get it wrong, we're fucking coming after you. Like, we know what the right answer is, but we won't tell. It's like so bizarre. But it's the same with this where they would just, and then you'd say a thing. They'd be like, nope, that broke the rules. And you're like, okay, well, what do I do? And then they're like, you know, it was always so, there's never a person you can talk to. There's never anything. It's just these appeals. You have no idea what would go on in the appeal process. And then they'd come back. Your appeal was denied. And you'd be like, but I clearly was right here. Like, it just,
that's because anyway, they're smart enough to have the plausible deniability. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I dealt with this quite a few times on YouTube through the COVID regime, and it would go, we believe that what you stated might have violated our policies. And you can try and ask them, well, what do you think? Well, they don't want to tell you. And then you can go, here's why you're wrong. And they'll just go, well, we're denying it. But they don't want to actually take a stance and tell you what their position is. Cause then I guess you have something to fight them on. The most egregious one I ever got, and I won't give too many details of this, but it's post the COVID era, and I had a doctor on to defend basically current vaccines, and I was asking the critical questions, and it got pulled for asking the questions I was asking. Now, I was there to dig into the story a little bit, he largely defended that all of the vaccine regimen is a good idea and his idea as a medical healthcare practitioner. And that episode was pulled from YouTube.
Think about it. That is
shout out Dr. Krim. He rules.
that is such a perfect little example of how retarded the whole censorship regime is there too. Even when you're doing the thing that ostensibly is what they want, right? Like you're even playing the role of being like, hey, asking questions, regular Joe Schmo, and here's a legitimate professional to answer those questions in with the outcome that you guys probably would have wanted his position to be, and that still gets pulled. Yeah, that's a recipe for creating less extremism. All right. Anyway, speaking of extremism, of course, the thing we got to talk about up front is that there was this this shooting at the White House press, what do they call it? What I always get the correspondence dinner, which I don't know, man. What I mean, look, we got to talk about this for a few minutes here because there's a lot of interesting dynamics to this. I'm not coming out here like I have any type of theory about what just happened, which I see a lot of people jump to right away. That's never really been my style. I don't like to just, you know, wildly speculate about things, although certainly you understand why a lot of people do. But I don't know. I guess I would just say, first of all, it really is, you know, for people like me, and I was born in the 1980s and kind of grew up in the 80s and the 90s, we were like vaguely aware that the country had gone through a pretty crazy time in the 60s. And there was a lot of social upheaval, and that one of the elements of that crazy time was that like high level political assassinations happened to a lot. I mean, like, the big four being Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. I mean, these were like the, you know, highest level political assassinations, some of the most politically powerful and influential people. One was a president of the United States of America. One was running to be president of the United States of America as a former attorney general. One was the two leaders of, well, I guess I can't really say Malcolm X was the leader of the civil rights movement. I think he was very critical of it. But like the two leaders of Black Americans, both kids, like that's pretty crazy. And for most of my life, that was just kind of like a thing that was in the past that it was like, yo, those were crazy times back then, but we don't. Whatever problems we have, we don't have anything like that now. And between the two, you know, obviously Donald Trump at Butler and then the thing on the golf course, the other assassination attempt, Charlie Kirk being murdered, and now this, it does just feel like, oh my, like we've kind of not so slowly reached a point where that's just now part of the political reality in America. Does seem to only go toward Republicans. Haven't seen anything with high profile Democrats like quite this dramatic. And of course, you know, I've never seen, I don't know that I've ever seen a situation that's more ripe for conspiracy theories. Even though I open saying I'm not going to really like dive into them, I don't have any theories on this, but you know, the government just lies so much. I mean, they just all like everything they say, it's becoming, we've crossed into like late Soviet era style dynamics where everyone just knows, like, everyone, regular people know for a fact that if Joe Biden is debating Donald Trump, the truth is not even factored into either of their answers. Like they are just both very comfortable just lying through their teeth about whatever their latest thing is. When Donald Trump tells you how the war is going in Iran, you just know that it's completely full of shit and demonstrably so most of the time. We know the FBI lies and the CIA lies and the Justice Department lies. They're just all so criminal and so corrupt. So no one trusts anything they say. And it is the fact that Donald Trump after multiple assassination attempts, is ever still in a situation where his security is compromised? And I mean, in the most basic way, Rob, like, they're not checking credentials at the door. There's a non-metal detector entrance to the building where Donald Trump is speaking. Evidently, this guy made reservations at the hotel. It was a hotel I've stayed at before. I know the process of making reservations there. You know what it is? The same as every other hotel. Just call. Give him a credit card. And that's enough to get him access to be that close, one room away from where all the most powerful people in the world are? I mean, this is like... it. Listen, by the way, I'm not saying government incompetence can't explain a lot here. So maybe 100% of the explanation is government incompetence. But if that is the case, this is like some grotesque level negligence that is really kind of hard to believe. So I don't know. Any thoughts you have on any of this stuff, Rob? Because there's several avenues we could explore.
Yeah, I'll go the other way and just say I like Donald Trump pretending to shoot himself because it's more fun to talk about than the Iran war for a day. So we get to watch fun Trump for one day. This time he realized, you know, I don't even need to make my ear bleed. I can spook the press so that they stop with all their violent rhetoric and start going after the Democrats for all their violent rhetoric. Let's have him just shoot outside the doors, and then I can go pitch my ballroom and tell people that they can watch exclusive footage on Truth Social. So listen, I've spent the last 2 years or so just absolutely hating Donald Trump as he's talking about tariffs and as he's getting into these messy wars. But if he wants to do a WWF show of pretending to get shot and then pitch his ballroom in the sleaziest way possible, it makes for a more enjoyable news day.
Well, yeah, there's no question. There's fun. There's fun to that. You know, by the way, a lot's being made of, I don't know, maybe this is not the most important point to make, but it's just the one that's on my mind. But, you know, it's, you know, everyone's like looking at the videos of how exactly everyone handles it in real time. A lot of people noted that they got J.D. Vance out before they got Donald Trump out. I understand that there's a system there and that not everybody has control of it. And there's a, you know, a succession of like the, you know, where, okay, if you know, you have to protect all these people, the vice president is the second in line, you know, you're sitting right in that room, you've got like some of the most important people ever, and the Secret Service has their own protocols. But just as a man, as a human being watching this, and you watch so many of these guys who literally their security comes and gets them and they leave their wives, and I don't know, dude, just like on a human level, I cannot fathom a situation where there's immediate danger and I allow I get taken away and my wife is there. Is just no chance, dude. There's no chance. Those Secret Service agents would be fighting me now. Then they'll win because there's more of them. But like, it'd be a fist fight in the middle of this place. There's just no way you're going to, because what man would ever do that? This is like, I'm sorry, that is more important than your oath to the Constitution. That is more important than whatever dinner you're at, whatever job, much, much more important than your immediate physical safety. This is the most profound obligation you have. And I couldn't believe it. Now, I understand, like, maybe Bobby Kennedy doesn't have a choice in that moment, but I just, on some level, it just felt like the most, like, anti-human response to have. Like, it'd be like, it's like your kids, like the same, you know, if you were just like, okay, I got to get to safety and then we'll figure out if they're safe later. Like, what? I don't know. That genuinely blows my mind to see people.
I was really enjoying the entertainment value of kind of the social hierarchy of what was going on. Between who's being pulled out, who's not. I saw some video, someone's like yelling, Steve, can we come with you, Steve? And I just thought, it's like the ultimate, like trying to get into the club, but I guess it's having Secret Service bring you to safety. And then also when they gave the speech afterwards, and you can see the guy standing on the sideline of who should be getting on stage, and Kash Patel offers the spot next to Donald Trump to J.D. Vance, but he was already standing there, and J.D. Vance kind of recognizes it's weird, so... I did find all that to be just, and some people just stealing bottles, some people ditching their wives, some people helping their wives. I found all that hilarious. On J.D. Vance being pulled out first, my read on that was they're sitting on opposite sides of the stages. They've already gone to get Donald Trump, and Donald Trump kind of falls over because they're leaning on him, or he decides to hit the floor. So like, they're already taking Donald Trump out the opposite side. J.D. Vance is just younger and more spry. So when they go to get him, he's like technically like
grabbed by a jacket and pulling aside. He'll be fine.
Just saying he's technically out sooner, but it didn't get in the way of taking out Donald Trump, nor do I. So like, I know that other people pointed to that, and maybe it should be all hands on deck for the president first until he's out of the room. But I don't know security protocols enough, and that one just kind of made sense to me. Like, vice president's right here, different exit, go.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think people are making a lot out of things that don't necessarily mean anything. I mean, I saw a lot of people really trashing Cash Patel, which I must admit was very funny. But there wasn't really any substance to it. Like, I understand you're the FBI director, but like that... The FBI is, you know, like people would be saying, oh, the FBI director is just sitting around doing nothing. Like, it's not really the purview of the FBI to like be dealing with an active shooter situation at a Secret Service event. You know what I'm saying? Like, they deal with the FBI would be investigating later what happened here. But it does just undeniably look awful. Like, you're just
It's not just that. Sometimes you're in emergency situations, you're actually getting in the way of people who can help. This was odd, but in synagogue on Rosh Hashanah, some dude had like a full out stroke. And if you want to have a stroke somewhere, there's a lot of doctors in synagogue, so it's a good place to do it. And literally the guy sitting next to him was like an ER doctor, and he's on him. And I'm standing right there. I'm like, hey man, do you need a hand? He's like, no, I got it. Moved some chairs out, walked out of the way. Literally just left the room to make space. And then like, all, you know, people like just start getting in the way where like they're trying to. If you're Cash, it's not your squad. There's people who are on the security protocol. And if you're currently in an emergency situation, you're probably not doing anything to help anything.
Yeah, no, you can't do anything to help. It's not, he wasn't doing anything wrong, but it just looks bad.
Yeah, you'll get in the way of some Secret Service guy who's actually got something like immediate to do.
What you gotta do, right, is like you gotta just go over to like someone who does work for you or something like that, and you gotta just start like pointing at them like real aggressively, like, real important stuff. Like, for everybody, back off. I'm working here. Like, even when he's on the phone, he's got to be like yelling on the phone. Like, you know, you got to make it like,
you know, said, yeah, no, you got to flip over the table and take out your gun and just point it at the door as if you were ready for absolutely nothing.
Yeah. Well, that would have been a better look for sure. Anyway, you know, I guess what's being reported, more details will come out about this. The guy is alive.
It wasn't a stroke, by the way. It was a seizure, just for the record.
Seizure. Okay. Well, either one of those are tough. Still, the point holds. But, you know, at least from what they're saying now, from what's initially being reported, he had written some manifesto or something about how the government are all a bunch of, you know, pedophiles and war criminals, and I will not allow you to do this in my name type thing. And I will say, I'm not saying that that is true. Believe me, nobody is going to tell you more that you shouldn't trust what any of these people say. All I'm saying is that is possible. And it is something much like with the blowback argument that like, hey, you're going to go around the world slaughtering people. At the very least, go into that with your eyes open and know that that might lead to some people really hating you and wishing to do violence against you in retaliation. And in the same sense, it's like, yeah, I mean, there probably is a limit of how criminal the government can be, how much they can lie to you, the level of evil that they will commit before you might be dealing with people who snap over that. Now, of course, there's also like individual psychological issues that go along with that too. Most well-adjusted people are not going to grab a gun and run into a room full of politicians, and nor do we want reasonable people to be pushed to that point, but that there's not only well-balanced people in a big country like this, there's also a whole lot of people who are on the edge. And of course, I'm not justifying any political violence at all. And I think it's a very bad path for us to go down as a society. But I also do think it's worth recognizing that, like, look, maybe none of that's true. Maybe there's some hidden conspiracy here. Maybe it was faked. Maybe, like, whatever. I don't know. But it's also quite possible that that's just really reality. And that, like, You know, there's a, you know, things like, you know, you cover up the Epstein files and then you launch a war. Hey, there's no relation between that at all. It sure doesn't look good. That's for sure. Sure doesn't look good to most people. And it is, perhaps there's a risk to that, you know, of creating more moments like this. Just a thought.
Well, everybody, don't engage in violence. They'll just strip our freedoms. The next thing you'll hear is that they got to shut down tracks and they'll start poisoning the water that you all eat more. They'll take away Ozempic because we can't have people running too fast because it's a security risk for the president of the United States of America. So
they're going to make you fat again.
Just remember, they're better at using violence than we are. Yeah. And if you make an environment that suits them, that they can be more violent towards us to protect their own safety, they will gladly do it.
Yeah. The worst thing in the world you could do when people are starting to wake up to the evil of this system is to start being violent and dangerous and causing chaos, because that's exactly the type of thing. Like, look, in the same way, I remember I used to bring this up all the time, but just as an example, and obviously this is just a story of one person, but I think it does represent something. But I remember it's my father-in-law, my Fox News watching father-in-law. I remember the day or the day after George Floyd was killed, I brought the kids, or maybe it was just one kid at the time, over to his house. And we were out in his yard having a beer and talking about it. And he literally, the first thing he said to me was, he goes, that cop and every one of those cops should have been put in handcuffs on national television. They should all be tried for murder. Like, he was just appalled at, you know, what almost everyone saw at the time. Like, dude, a guy who's, whatever you think of him, clearly a drug addict and a criminal, but the guy is not being violent. He's not a dangerous threat. He's cuffed. He's on the ground. He's screaming for his mother. And this cop has his knee right on his neck for like 9 minutes until the guy dies on camera. And all the other cops are just sitting there. Like, it's just so indefensible. And I know right wingers can give me arguments about, oh, one of the autopsies said it was the fentanyl. Like, okay, yeah. You still can't treat people like that. And they end up dying, it's on you. Anyway, and I remember watching this. I remember watching the Fox News father-in-law. That was his response. And then you talk to, like, a couple months later, the nation's been torn up by riots. There's been massive crimes and looting and murders and savage assaults and almost every major city over this shit. And just tens of millions of regular people just terrorized by these mobs. These mobs are running up on restaurants and demanding you chant Black Lives Matter with a clear implicit threat of violence. Like, you know, just shop owners being assaulted in horrific ways. And what was my Fox News watching father saying? That you all know what he was saying. That he goes, send in the National Guard. What are we doing? Send in the 82nd Airborne. Put this whole thing down with whatever force. So in other words, the point is that even if you have someone who's like waking up and going, hey, maybe you got a really good point. Maybe there is a problem with the way cops are treating people. Reacting with chaos and violence is the surest way to ensure that they are going to turn around and support whatever authoritarian government tyrannical policy it is that the politicians are selling as the cure for that. And for understandable reasons, right? Because as bad as it may be, if cops are violating the rights of Americans, whatever rung of society that might be, that's a problem, right? That is a big problem. And that's something that almost everyone would acknowledge is something that, ooh, yeah, you don't want to have that. We want to deal with that. But obviously, complete anarchy, and I don't mean this in the libertarian sense, I mean just in pure chaos, but chaos and violence and riots are worse. They're just objectively worse than that. You're better off being in a system where, yeah, there's some, you know, institutionalized corruption or some institutionalized violence, but at least there's order. You know what I mean? At least you think, like, there's a reasonable chance I can go to work and then go pick up my kid and then go back home and everything will be okay, then just total chaos. So in the same sense that, you know, people might be waking up to how corrupt the Trump administration is, or the entire American regime for that matter. I mean, yeah, you see people running around just killing people. That is going to drive them way back to support whatever whatever mechanism is offered to them to deal with that for understandable reasons. And, you know, as Rob was saying, believe me, the bad guys are well aware that we're winning the war of ideas. They're well aware of that. In fact, every single time they speak, that's all they can talk about. It is like their major focus. And they would love nothing more than one of you guys to give them the excuse to crack down on all of us. And so, yes, please do not give them that excuse.
Which makes you wonder if they did it themselves.
Well, I do.
And then it is interesting to me because, listen, I'm a free speech absolutist, and I think if your words inspire someone else to go partake in violence, you're not responsible for that person's behavior. And I think that that's a more dangerous line to try and implement, because then it becomes very easy to try and cast blame on people who are just speaking and sharing ideas as if rhetoric leads to violence. With that said, there is something, too, if politicians – like if you're Kamala Harris and you're calling Donald Trump a fascist in a country that's this large, you might inspire someone to think that they're being a hero, that, oh, wow, look, our political system wasn't able to deal with this fascist. And I was just told by the Democratic Party that this guy's Hitler, or he's a fascist. I need to do something. And I don't think the politicians should not be allowed to speak that way. But it is interesting to see, I guess, the liberals be held somewhat accountable for, you know, kind of a breakdown in form in the language that they used in trying to depict Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like there's no question that for the last decade, the media and the Democratic establishment, almost the entire Democratic Party, there's no question that they turned the rhetoric up to 11 and that there's dangers that come along with that. And there's no question, right? I mean, they're, you know, the rhetoric of Trump is Hitler and it's the end of democracy. You know, look, they told everyone, all three elections really, but particularly this last one, they told everyone that democracy was on the line. Like this was it. Like we lose the nation if we elect Donald Trump. And then we elected Donald Trump. So inherently, what have you told them there? You've told them that, like, the peaceful mechanism is over and that now there's right. So there's a point to that. I think the problem that Donald Trump has in prosecuting that case is that he's the most, you know, he's the most reckless, biggest shit talker ever. And so for him to ever go like that's irresponsible rhetoric out of you, just immediately you want to laugh in his face because it's just too ridiculous. And of course, even though there have not been targeted violence in the same way against Democratic leaders, they absolutely could turn back at him and say, you've said all the same things or at least a different version of the same thing. You know what I mean? Toward us. So unfortunately, we're just not, I don't think we're living in a time where the temperature is getting turned down. And even, you know, like if that were going to happen, then Charlie Kirk getting shot in the neck and bleeding out right in front of all of us would have been the moment that that happened. And what happened? You know, a bunch of the lefties on TikTok started celebrating it. A bunch of right wingers started, you know, whatever. I mean, I guess I'm not trying to make an equivalency there, but like certainly that did not lead to any of the tone returning to more normalcy or something like that. So I just, if that didn't make it happen, Trump getting shot didn't make it happen. I just don't see how it goes back in that direction at this point. Here, let's play a little bit of Donald Trump's interview. So Donald Trump, so they cancel. Well, first, right, Rob, if I'm getting the order of this correct, first they come on, they announce that the event is continuing. You know, like, give us another minute, it's going to continue. Then they're like, okay, none of that's continuing at all. Then they go back and do, like, a press conference in the press room, which was odd. They're all in tuxedos. It was just, like, an odd kind of feeling. And then Donald Trump sits down for this interview. And so let's take a look at this, where there's a bizarre, bizarre moment in this interview where they read a passage from the manifesto and then ask Donald Trump about it.
The so-called manifesto is a stunning thing to read, Mr. President. He appears to reference a motive in it. He He writes this quote, administration officials, they are targets. And he also wrote this, I am no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. What's your reaction
to
that?
Well, I was waiting for you to read that because I knew you would, because you're horrible people, horrible people. Yeah, he did write that. I'm not a rapist. I didn't rape anybody.
You think he was referring to you?
Excuse me. I'm not a pedophile. You read that crap from some sick person. I got associated with all stuff that has nothing to do with me. I was totally exonerated. Your friends on the other side of the plate are the ones that were involved with, let's say, Epstein or other things. But I said to myself, you know, I'll do this interview and they'll probably, I read the manifesto, you know, he's a sick person, but you should be ashamed of yourself reading that because I'm not any of those things.
Mr. President, and I was never,
excuse me, you shouldn't be reading that on 60 Minutes. You're a disgrace, but go ahead. Let's finish the interview.
The other thing that he wrote in
I just pause it there. This is just an utterly bizarre defensive reaction by Donald Trump. And I'm curious your thoughts on this, Rob, but to me, Nora O'Donnell there, I think that's her name, right? Nora O'Donnell. I think she used to be on NBC back in the day. She's reading the words of a crazy gunman. It's not as if that's being presented as like that's the best possible light for Donald Trump's framing, that he could just own it and be like, yeah, this is what insane violent people think. And this is not, or something. But he turns it on her, immediately takes the accusation to be about himself, and then keeps calling her disgusting for reading it. But like, she wasn't taking a position. I don't know. I found that to be very bizarre. Maybe you have a different take than me. I'll say this, and then I'll kick it over to you. Look, I'm not saying Donald Trump's a pedophile. I'm not saying Donald Trump's a rapist. I'm not saying he's not. I don't know. But this claim that Donald Trump is making, that the Epstein files totally exonerate him. And I'm sure that somebody on his team has said that and he really liked that. So he keeps repeating it every time it's come up. The major problem with that is that it's just not true. Like, it is just not true that anything in the Epstein files came out that made you go, oh, well, look at this. Trump couldn't have been involved in any wrongdoing. That just didn't happen. Now, you can make the argument that one not need be exonerated. Like, hey, I haven't been charged with a crime and I'm innocent until proven guilty. So I don't need to be exonerated. Even in court, you know, you don't really need to be exonerated exactly. You need to find a shadow of a doubt. Finding a shadow of a doubt is not exactly the same thing as being, you know, like proven innocent. But that's our system and it's better than the alternative. But Donald Trump, it's like, dude, there's 3 million files that you are illegally still covering up right now. Openly. They've openly admitted that there's 3 million more files and that they will not be releasing them. I'm sorry, dude. Like, yes, it seems very clear that you were pretty chummy with Jeffrey Epstein at one point. You guys had a falling out and then no longer were pretty chummy. He was still pretty chummy with a lot of people around you. But the idea of going, oh, this just proved that I'm totally exonerated and it's just the Democrats. They were the ones involved. Dude, Letnick was on the island and lied about it. He's in your government, not the Democrats' government. So I'm sorry, but this line is just not landing, partially because it's complete bullshit. Anyway, go ahead, Rob. What do you think?
All right. Well, you know, I agree with you on the Epstein part. And it's always fun when you and I actually don't see things the same way. But in this case, you know, I think it's bad to give coverage to the ideas of these shooters because it gives them a platform for actually getting the message out. And I think it does kind of incentivize the behavior. And I also think this is, I mean, Donald Trump plays this game also, but it's the classic, I'm not saying, but somebody's saying, and then affiliating someone with something that's horrible, which is like kind of a classic news trick of you're having an interview and they're like, well, you know, there's people out there that are calling you a pedophile. How do you address this? Now that puts that into reality of, oh, this person's affiliated with being a pedophile. Yeah, yeah. And now they have to actually respond to it. And it both kind of gives coverage and reasserts the fact of, oh, there's a reason for this person to have to respond to the fact that they're not a pedophile. So the fact that someone engaged in a shooting and wrote a line, and then you force the president to address like, hey, how do you want to respond to this? You are forcing the guy to like dignify it with the response. And
right, I think fair enough. That is a fair point.
I think it's both bad form to actually read the or put out the minute. Like, people can go find it online, but I think we do have a problem of that it's a way to get attention and even share a message by engaging in violence. And then also it's the classic news trick of, you know, I'm not making this claim, but other people say you're a pedophile. How do you want to respond to them? It's like, I don't want to address that question because you shouldn't even be asking me it.
Fair enough. Those are both fair points. I guess I would just say that it's a bit of a balancing act, right? With as far as the point you make about reading the manifesto on TV, because then it's like, oh, look what you just gave him. You essentially just said you get your words read on TV if you go out and commit an act like this. And this has been a long debate, like since Columbine, which happened when I was in school. I can't remember exactly how old I was, but it happened on my birthday too. Which I remember we had an assembly that morning in my school, and I was like, you guys didn't have to do all this, you know, it's just my birthday. It wasn't about me. But look, there's a debate about how much should we cover these things, you know, like, because there's no question that there is a copycat phenomenon. And I don't know if this is solely the reason why school shootings became a regular occurring thing after Columbine, but quite plausibly part of it is that you put this out into the ether and it is kind of like a bat signal to every crazy kid out there. Like, oh, that's an option. Maybe they didn't even think about that before, but like, you get a gun reasonably easy in this country. I mean, I don't know. I knew kids who had guns when I was a teenager, illegally, but you know, we used to joke about how it was a lot easier to get weed than booze when I was like 15. Because when I was like 15, that was like before even fake IDs we had like in my group of friends. Cause you know, like when you're like 17, 18, we all started going to the West Village and buying a fake ID and then using it. But when you're 15, you really can't pass for 21. You know what I mean? Like you go up with an ID, no matter what you're, as soon as you pull out the ID, the person's like, let me see this fake bullshit. Cause there's no way you're 21. But your local weed dealer had a no ID policy. And so that was really easy to get it from. Anyway, not that we didn't get booze. It was just harder. But so anyway, there's a point there that like maybe you put this out into the world. People can go get guns. They can go. I guess the counter to that would just be, Rob, is that on some level, you do want to understand what the motivations of these people are. And on some level, like in the same way that like covering Columbine might lead to more Columbines, but also Columbine happening is news. And what the hell is the news if we can't talk about something that is that newsworthy? So I'm not saying you're wrong. I get your point. Maybe I'm just a little more conflicted on what the right answer there is. And I guess in other words, I'm saying, dude, like, if you think about covering up the Epstein files and you think about what that really is and how profound a betrayal to the American people of your most basic duty to them, like it is almost worth knowing that, yeah, that might be the type of thing that pushes someone who's probably already pretty close to falling off the edge over the edge. I guess that's would more or less be my point there. Do you think, is there more in this interview that in this segment that you think is worth going over, or should we switch gears here? Cause I really want to get to, Alan Dershowitz.
Yeah, let's go to, I don't remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. I really just wanted to talk about this Alan Dershowitz thing. In fact, this is what I was planning on, really spending most of the show on, but then, you know, this happened as that's the business we're in. Sometimes that happens. And then also I think I'm in like 50 different Twitter beef feuds now, which I don't want to spend too much time on, but I did just want to all right. Casually, I got into a thing. So there was a bunch of stuff that I wanted to talk about. And then one of them was Randy Fine going on the Tim Pool show. And then I saw our buddy Clint Russell did a show on that the other day. And that was just, it was perfect. I just thought it was great. Clint's the man. If you guys don't watch his shows, one of the best shows out there. Still, I always say Clint's criminally underrated. I've just been saying that for years, but then he really blew up. So I don't know if I could keep saying, but he's still underrated. He deserves more than he's just excellent show. Liberty Lockdown, one of the best podcasts out there. So he did respond. So then I was kind of like, oh, good. One less thing I got to respond to. So I'm just going to tweet this. Like, this can serve as my response too, because I sign off on, I mean, maybe not every word, but just about every word. And but then when I did that, Tim had a whole response to me. And I know that me and Tim have kind of, you know, I was a little bit harsh on him when I was criticizing him last time. We did like a little debate. It wasn't really much of a debate on Piers Morgan's show. But like, I like Tim and I respect him. So anyway, maybe I'll respond to him like on the next episode or something there and just kind of explain. Because I didn't want it to come off like I was like attacking him. Although I did think, you know, he did not do a good job in that interview. And there's reasons that me and Clint were criticizing him for it. So that one... put a pin in. Looks like the Hassan Piker debate is going to happen.
Ooh, where's that going down?
We have not set it up yet, but he did. He responded to our last episode, and was like, "Well, he mentioned something which was true. Was that he had messaged me? He had sent me a DM, like I don't know, maybe last year or something like that. Where he was saying like, hey, you know, we don't agree on a lot." But I appreciate you, you know, holding the line on Gaza or something like that. And I didn't respond, which, you know, I don't know. I just, you know, he said on this thing, he's like, I don't know. Dave talks about like Kyle Kalinske and Mehdi Hassan. And he goes, look, man, I'm not trying to fight with you guys. We agree on a lot of the same issues. Like, how come he doesn't have that same energy with me? And I don't know, because I just don't. Maybe there's not the best answer for it. I don't know. He is much more obnoxious to me. And I haven't seen those guys putting forth the like straight up communist, like you should steal from people, you should kill landlords, you should like all that shit. Like, I don't know. I haven't really seen that from them. And if I did see it from them, I'd probably disagree with it in the exact same manner. But also, Hassan's done like 5 or 6 segments on me over the years, been very disrespectful, been very sure of himself while he's making the dumbest fucking argument imaginable. And so like, yeah, that's the same attitude I have when I see, it's just, I don't know this. It's like seeing that New York Times article, Rob, it's like or New York Times podcast. It's like this, there's a particular disgust I have for this, like what's his name? I'm blanking on his name. Ah, shoot. He was the guy who used to, I got to message him back. Clay, who used to run our like fan page back in the day. As he put it, there is something particularly infuriating about this brand of regime-approved communism. You know what I mean? Like, it's like the New York... You're such a revolutionary, but the paper of record, the most powerful, prestigious newspaper in the world, sees nothing threatening at all about you and is happy to have this conversation with you. It's like kind of tough. Anyway, he did reach out to me. He DM'd me, or maybe I DM'd him. And because people were saying, because he had said, hey, man, why didn't you respond to my message? If you wanted a debate, you should have just responded to me. And I was like, well, no, dude, you were a huge show sniping at me when I was first coming up. And I publicly challenged you to debate every time you did a segment on me. And maybe you were unaware of that. Fine. But that never happened. Then years later, you just messaged me. You're doing good work on this. And I didn't respond because I just wasn't interested in starting a dialogue. But he did say on the thing, hey, if you want to do the debate, blah, 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 that you should just message me or something like that. So I did. He responded. He was like, do you want to do it in person or do you want to do it remotely? Do you want to do it? And I said, well, I travel a lot. It's probably going to be tough to make in-person work. Why don't we just do it remotely? And anyway, I said, we can do it on your show, my show, or with a moderator on whatever platform you want. So I've left it up to whatever he wants to do. I'm down to do it. I think that'll be a huge debate. And, you know, he's one of the biggest lefty streamers out there. And I think it's an important one. And let's see, you know, if he can defend this idea of advocating theft. And, you know, I don't know. Look, when it comes to, for whatever reason, when it comes to Hassan Piker, I'm more interested in arguing over that stuff than I am just agreeing about the wars. Yep. When it comes to Cenk Uygur, his uncle, more interested in just agreeing about the wars. It's kind of a judgment call. It's just how I feel about the person and what value slash negatives they're bringing to the broader conversation. Okay. So anyway, looks like that debate's happening. The other one I'll mention very quickly is this Dan Blazarian guy who's now talking shit about me on Twitter, who essentially, so as I'm in this argument with Hassan, he then goes, well, you've been ducking having a good faith conversation with me. So Dan Blazarian, for people who don't know, is like running for Congress against Randy Fine or something like that. He goes, oh, you're ducking a conversation with me. So I responded and I went, look, I wouldn't exactly call it ducking, but sure, I'll have a conversation with you. So I agreed to have the conversation with him. Then his response is, he goes, I don't know why you're lying about this. Lots of people have been trying to put us in contact. And I'm like, well, first of all, I'm not lying about anything. And like, it's kind of weird. He goes, let's have a good faith conversation. I go, okay. And then he goes, you're a liar. Now, when he says lying, he means that I said the framing that I'm ducking him is ridiculous. Yes, like three different people. I think Jake Shields, Sneeko, and I think someone else over the last couple years has let me know that Dan Blazarian really wants to talk to me. Just haven't really been interested in. Now, if you want to call that ducking, I mean, okay. I guess we're all ducking everyone we don't talk to every day. Like, oh, okay, fine. But like, I think that's kind of ridiculous framing. I'll try to be as diplomatic and as libertarian about this as I can. Hey, everyone has the right to be the person they want to be and live the life they want to be. Dan Blazarian has just never been my cup of tea. I'm just not that into it. I'm not particularly impressed with some of the stuff that he's saying. And I kind of see him as being more of a net negative than a net positive in the people who are against Israel. But like, anyway, so then he posts that he goes, I'm lying. And I know that I've told multiple people that I'm scared to have the conversation with him, which is just a lie. Like, I've never said that ever. Yes, you're right, dude. I've talked to Nick Fuentes and Sneeko and Christopher Cantwell and Richard Spencer and like all these people, but you are just, I was just so scared of the implications of the conversation with you. I just did Jake Shields' podcast last year. Like, I don't know. It just doesn't even make any sense. I just wasn't interested. But I don't know. Maybe we'll do that one too. Who knows? Anyway, and then his fans are all just like so retarded. Like, they're like, look at Dave making excuses because he's scared. You're like, I accepted. I said yes. What is with you retards? And then it's all just like, it really is even what Nick Fuentes calls. It's like his bait just seems to be the lowest IQ Jew-hating shit. Because it's like every comment is just like, well, once a Jew, always a Jew. He exposes himself. And you're like, you guys are out of your fucking mind. Okay. Anyway, enough about that. I just did want to get those responses out on the podcast. Let's go to this Alan Dershowitz clip here, dude, because, and this isn't even a clip, actually. I'm just got us playing from the episode. This kind of happened. It was a big show. Don't get me wrong. It Piers Morgan show always does huge numbers. But I thought this was like one of the most tremendously revealing interviews I've ever seen. It almost kind of proves everything that we've been talking about for a long time. And in this very bizarre way where Alan Dershowitz doesn't even seem to recognize the implications of what he's saying here. If you remember, Rob, I had mentioned this on the show because I found this to be a very interesting moment. That was the last time Pierce had Alan Dershowitz on, or maybe not the last time, but a previous time that he had him on. Alan Dershowitz, of course, for people who don't know, is like a very prestigious, prominent, famous lawyer.
Can I pipe in on that?
Yeah, sure.
It's incredible to me to have both been Epstein's lawyer and famous for getting OJ off and be treated as a prestigious individual and not like a Better Call Saul lawyer.
He also represented Benjamin Netanyahu, if that makes you feel any better.
I don't know. There just seems to be something broken. I hate to say this as you go into your Hassan Piker interview, but something broken with our capitalist system that if you make a fortune as a, a lawyer doing this kind of work, we still celebrate you as look at how good of a lawyer you are.
It's truly unbelievable. Yes. Yeah. It's truly unbelievable that Mossad wouldn't just say, hey, we can't have the same lawyer as Jeffrey Epstein. Like, we can both have scumbag lawyers, but we can't have the same one. And they go, no, that's cool. Get that one in there. He's, you know, he defended Epstein, but if it makes you feel any better, he also defended Michael Jackson. So there, I don't know. Did I make that up? I think he might have defended Michael Jackson.
I'm not sure. I can't remember. And he's okay. Litigious. He'll come after you.
As I get, well, I just said, did I make that up? I may have. I left you with the possibility that I just, no, I might have gotten that wrong. But anyway, definitely Epstein and Benjamin Netanyahu. But so there was this moment, I had mentioned this to you, I think both on and off air, because I thought this was very interesting. So Piers Morgan had John Mearsheimer, the co-author of The Israel Lobby and the dean of the Realist School of Foreign Policy, brilliant, you know, geopolitical expert thinker. And he had Alan Dershowitz. Now, they weren't going back and forth. I think it was like he interviewed, if I'm remembering correctly, he interviewed Mearsheimer and then interviewed Dershowitz. But so at one point, knowing that Alan Dershowitz is coming up in the next segment, John Mearsheimer, you know, he said, well, Alan Dershowitz is going to argue this. And John Mearsheimer goes, well, of course. I mean, he's the Israel lobby and that's what the lobby does. And then Alan Dershowitz came on and he responded and he goes, I mean, John called me the Israel lobby. I'm the Israel lobby now. Like, I'm not lobbying on behalf of anything. I'm an American and I have a right to say what I think about this. And at least superficially, I could see where there was a little bit of an argument to what Alan Dershowitz was saying. Like, well, what do you mean? You just lumped me in like I'm part of the lobby. Like, I'm not speaking here as a representative of AIPAC or something like that. Like, I'm just a, but of course, the argument has always been that it's like, no, look, the Israel lobby has to be thought of as like this loosely coordinated groups of organizations and individuals who advocate on behalf of Israel as their political priority. And this is why I very much like when Megyn Kelly started using the term Israel firsters, because that's a little bit more specific, you know, like it's like, okay, you're the one whose first priority is Israel. Like, okay, so call it the Israel lobby, call it Israel firsters. The point is that, so here you have, this is just a few weeks ago, Rob, maybe a couple months ago, that he's going, what do you mean I'm the Israel lobby? That's nuts. I'm just Alan Dershowitz, the lawyer who happens to work with the Israeli government, but like, don't let that fuck with you. And then, okay, so one of the things, Alan Dershowitz has been prominent for my entire life, as long as I can remember. He's been a famous lawyer. And he's always been a Democrat. That was also something that he's known as. So he has now announced that he is leaving the Democrats. He has become a Republican, and he goes on Piers Morgan to talk about it. So we're going to listen to Pierce's opening and then his opening comments here. Let's play.
Well, popular support for Israel is plummeting in the U.S., a fact borne out by poll after poll. More Americans now sympathize with the Palestinians than they do with Israelis for the first time in history. And support is falling across all age groups and all political affiliations, even Republicans. Many people tend to blame Tucker Carlson for this, but voters tell surveys it has much more to do with the destruction of Gaza and the war in Iran. It's a profound shift in public opinion. And whoever wants to replace Donald Trump as president will have to take a position on it. Governor Josh Shapiro and Rahm Emanuel are both Jewish politicians who want to be the next Democratic president. They both blame Netanyahu for dragging the U.S. into the Iran war. And Emanuel says it's time to stop spending American taxes on the Israeli military altogether. All of this was too much for legal scholar and longtime Democrat Alan Dershowitz. He announced this week that he's registering as a Republican for the first time in his life, calling Democrats the most anti-Israel party in the history of the United States. He may find that the Republicans are asking themselves many of the same questions. Joe Kent, a Gold Star husband and retired Green Beret, resigned as director of the National Counterterrorism Center over Israel's influence on the Iran war. And both Alan Dershowitz and Joe Kent join me now. Welcome to both of you. Alan, I never thought I'd have the potential to introduce you as...
By the way, can you just pause it here for a second? I'll just quickly say just like some nice words about Piers Morgan here, because I really do love the guy, despite disagreeing with him on a lot of stuff. But Piers is just a guy. I just want to hang with Piers more. Like, you're just like, dude, we got to grab a beer. But, you know, for all the shit people give Piers for his show, And, you know, obviously it is a circus at times, and it devolves into food fights at times. And I've participated in some of those food fights. But by the way, this whole moment is incredible. And it's amazing that he created, by the way, Joe Kent says a lot of really great, important stuff, but we're not going to play any of that on the show. So please do go watch the episode. But I just want to pick on Alan Dershowitz. I'm not interested in all the good stuff Joe Kent said. But this is just such a great debate to be able to set up right now. And this is the place where you could hear these two guys go at it. Just wanted to say that. Props to Piers Morgan. Let's get into Alan Dershowitz now.
Why do you feel so strongly about this, that you have renounced your Democratic faith and gone to the other side?
Well, the polls show that the vast majority of Democrats of every age oppose Israel. They have elected a congresswoman from New Jersey who is virulently anti-Israel. They may be nominating a Senate candidate from Michigan who campaigns with a neo-Nazi who basically is a Hitler supporter. And as you say, even Rahm Emanuel has now said that the Democrats should stop and the United States government should reorganize its relationship with Israel and treat it like any other ally. And in light of what's going on on university campuses.
Pause it. Now, I just want to just take this in for a second. Just take this in. Only a few weeks after arguing that it's absurd to consider him a part of the Israel lobby, he has now switched his lifelong political affiliation. I don't know if you got a picture in your mind, if you just saw Alan Dershowitz, and I know if you can look past the raw sexual magnetism or whatever Barry Weiss described him as. He's old. He has now abandoned his lifelong political affiliation, and he does not even pretend it's over any other issue. Clearly, then, the only reasonable thing we can deduce is that this is the most important issue to you. And what is he, even in his own words, he says that now the Democratic Party is a party that believes that Israel should be treated just like any other ally, not like an enemy. Not that we ought to declare war on Israel. Not that we ought, that we, they should be another ally, but not the ally who gets unconditional support no matter what. And that is enough for Jeffrey Epstein's lawyer to go, I'm out then. Then I'm out. Then I'm going with the Republicans. It doesn't matter if we don't agree on any other issues, or if we disagree on many other issues, to be more charitable. But that is, I'm sorry, the only reasonable thing that you can deduce from that is that your highest political value is U.S. support for Israel. And there's a real fucking problem with that. And like so many of these people, it's like, you know, the old, the fish doesn't know that he's in water type thing. Like they say that, they admit this, and they don't see that there's any major glaring problem, because what you are admitting there, this isn't like having some, listen, you could have taxes as your number one issue. You'd have guns as your number one issue. You could have war and peace as your number one issue. You have monetary policy, immigration policy, regulatory, like you could have whatever issue is your number one issue. But if your number one issue is a foreign government, a foreign country, then that is treasonous by nature. That you are saying you are more loyal. Alan Dershowitz, famous American. He is a famous, rich American. However he got there, Rob, and whether you think culturally he should be, you know, famous for that work, that's what he is. And he's openly telling you, I am loyal to a foreign government, and then starts musing about questions of why so many people are saying negative things about the Jews. So many people are critical of Israel. And some of them are even talking about how Jews have dual loyalty. It is the fish not seeing water. Like he can make this announcement and then still act dumbfounded by anyone having the reaction. But like, I don't know, Rob, tell me if you think I'm being crazy. It is incompatible with the slightest dose of patriotism to tolerate that. Anybody who is a little bit of patriotism in them goes, look, man, there aren't that many rules, but one of the rules is you can't be more loyal to a foreign country than you are to your own. Otherwise, you're not truly a citizen in, and I don't mean that just in like the legal sense. I mean that in like the deepest philosophical sense. You're not really a citizen of a country if you have an allegiance to a foreign country, which he just admitted he does in as plain English as can possibly be admitted. And I kind of couldn't believe more people weren't making a bigger deal out of that. Maybe it's just because the case has already been proven, but like, look at that, dude. This is insane. And your thoughts, Rob?
Well, we're tight on time, and I agree with everything you said. So we can let's continue because there were some other moments I was real fascinated by.
Yes, let's can extend this show by another 10 minutes or so. Let's keep getting into this.
The uptick of anti-Semitism around the world, I just can't be associated with a political party that has become part of the anti-Israel, anti-Jewish trend around the world and in the United States. So although I support many of the Democratic domestic policies, I will vote and work hard to make sure that the Republicans maintain control over the House, the
just,
Senate,
all right,
and the
here, pause it again 1 second.
To avoid.
And I listen, man, it's just even right there, right? Just read between the lines, the tiniest bit. I agree with the Democrats on their domestic policy, but I'll be voting Republican over Israel. Like, doesn't that just say it all right there, Rob? Like, oh, yeah. No, even from his own worldview, he goes, oh, yeah, no, this is much worse for America. But I'm going to go for it anyway because I think it's what's better for Israel. That's a full admission right there, dude. Like, this is like on a at a murder trial, finding out that the guy Googled what to do with a dead body the night of. You know what I mean? Like, this is holy shit, dude. This is as good as an admission of guilt, essentially. All right, let's keep playing.
The United States from moving the way many European countries have moved away from Israel, away from support for Western values and in support for radical left-wing values. Look, if I could have registered as a Republican with a little asterisk saying I'm basically a foreign policy Republican, I'm still a domestic Democrat, I would do that, but that choice is not available to me. And so consistent with my values, I want to quote Ronald Reagan. I haven't left the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has left me, and I believe is quickly leaving America. And that's why I am going to work against the Democratic Party, particularly at a time when anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism is increasing around the world. You mentioned, by the way, that so many Americans are pro-Palestinian. Let's be very clear. Very few people really are pro-Palestinian. They're anti-Israel. If they were pro-Palestinian, they would also be supporting the Kurds, the Uyghurs. They would be supporting the Sudanese. They would be supporting the Ukrainians. You don't have demonstrations on university campuses in favor of these other oppressed groups, only for the Palestinians, not because of who they are, but because who allegedly oppresses them, namely the nation state of the Jewish people. So it's another manifestation of the increasing worldwide.
Yeah, I guess we pause it for a second there, because I just, again, even as he goes, even when you're going to say, you know, like, you get my point here, Rob, where even not just as he called it anti-Israelism, I don't know that I've heard that before, but even anti-Semitism, you just look at what a position he's in to not be able to say anything about that. Because look at you. That was your whole point on the last episode was, I'm not a member of the Israel lobby. I'm not a member of the Israel government. I'm just me. But just you is loyal to Israel. And that is you're an Israel firster by definition. So that's the Israel lobby. And then, I mean, I don't know. I don't know, Rob. I think we've just dealt with that garbage point enough. Oh, if you really cared about the Palestinians, you'd always also have to care about the Uyghurs or something like that. Like, look, man, whatever China is doing to the Uyghur Muslim population, it's not exactly what Adrian Zenz lied or got the math wrong about. But sure, we're against it. Don't oppress anyone. But it is just obviously different when a nation is like just brutally repressing a group of people with our full support and only able to do it because we support them with our tax dollars. That's just different. Also, it's really just not a response to say, what about this terrible thing? Well, what about this other terrible thing? It's like, I don't know. People specialize in different areas. We've dealt with this a million times. So I don't know if we need to spend too much more
China's,
time on that.
China's never been in our country telling us that they're the most moral while they're doing it, which would really catch the nation's attention, particularly if they were looking for funds and getting us involved in more chaos while telling us that they're the most moral. And believe me, if China was doing that, we'd be talking a lot more about what's going on with the Uyghurs.
Or yes, that's right. If China was if we were paying for China to round up Uyghurs and let's say like a huge portion of our elected officials had sworn that they were more loyal to China than they are to us, and let's say when Obama made his pivot to China, Alan Dershowitz stopped being a Democrat because he was so opposed, as a Chinese man, I'm so opposed to this, you know what I mean, or something like that. Like, just by the way, really do imagine that real people, Chinese Americans in positions of power, we're openly talking about their loyalty to China as a Chinese person. So imagine that for a second. You think we'd be talking about that a little bit more? I'm pretty sure we would.
And the threat of, by the way, they need to give those people a different name so I can more easily say it. That's on them. You know, they might get more support for their cause if they just went with a different name that could be more easily talked about in the United States of America.
It's dangerously close to a name we're not supposed to say that we really want to say and we're really trying not to say. So if you could try to work that out. Yeah. No, you're right. You got a fair point there too, Rob. Was there something more specifically you wanted to get to? Because I think that was more or less what my what I wanted to.
I mean, we're over time, but I just thought that this got more delicious as it went.
It did. It certainly did. There were more interesting points that he made. But look, we are over time. And that really, to me, is that was the essence of it, though. The biggest takeaway that you just like, look, ma'am, he literally even at one point says, hey, if I could be a domestic Democrat and a foreign policy Republican, I'd choose that option. Like, I'd rather not hurt our country to help Israel. But if I have to, I obviously will. Because obviously that's the priority. Now, I'm sorry, but I really think, and believe me, look, as everyone listening knows, and we've made this point many times, it's not just Jews who feel this way. There's lots of Christian Zionists and atheist Zionists who also have this same kind of allegiance, weirdly. But it is something I know that me and you talk about all the time, Rob, personally, because we're both Jewish and we both grew up around Jewish families and other had Jewish friends and stuff, that it's like, it is wild where someone like Alan Dershowitz can say this out loud. And I just happen to know, Rob, like there's a lot of Jewish people who will hear that. And it's like the fish doesn't realize he's in water. They'd go, I don't see what's controversial about that. Like, yeah, of course you support Israel. If they're not supporting Israel, then you got to go with the people who are supporting it. You know, it's like, but I really think it would behoove all of us to really examine that dynamic a little bit. And to go, look, right away, Rob, when you put it, you know, in World War II, we interned the Japanese Americans very unconstitutionally and immorally, I would argue, stripped them of their possessions, forced them into camps. Now, we didn't do that with the Italian Americans, I think just because there were too many of them. We didn't do that with German Americans, but there was a real concern about that back in the day, because you got to think, right? Like, just knowing kind of like this country and when the waves of immigration came, when if you know, like in Italian today, my wife's Italian, you know, by descent. Okay. It was her grandparents were the ones who came here. Most people, you know, it was their grandparents who came here, or maybe their great grandparents, but that's kind of what a lot, like most Americans, at least certainly in the part of the country where we are, that's their history. But so back then, these were people who had like direct ties. Many of them grew up there and then came here. And so you had a concern, like, are they going to be more loyal to their foreign government than they are to ours or whatever? But like, just imagine they actually were. I mean, we just simply would not tolerate that. If there were Chinese people talking about how they're loyal to the government of China, or if there were, we would just never tolerate that. And Jewish Americans likewise wouldn't tolerate that and would find that to be like outrageous. So what is the expectation that everyone else is supposed to tolerate this? This obvious, like, I don't know I just don't know how I can look at someone like Alan Dershowitz and not say that he's in effect a foreign spy. Then that's what you are. If you're here to be a figure in the media, to be an influential figure who's making arguments to people, but your number one political goal, your number one purpose is loyalty to a foreign government, to me, that's being a foreign spy. Plain and simple. All right, we're going to wrap up there. See you guys this weekend. Tulsa, Oklahoma City. Really looking forward to all these shows. Catch you guys tomorrow on the podcast. Peace.